Everything you need, one place. Freedom 970.
Freedom970.com.
The Six Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to Portland's longest-running financial show that has a financial advisor, a estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions live on the air, free, and free's a really good price. My name is Chuck Price, President of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, and it's kind of great to be back in the studio. We've been gone for a little bit. Hopefully, you've enjoyed our replays, and I do want to make an announcement that next Saturday, we will have Rodney Johnson on the air with us live, so you can ask questions of Rodney Johnson. He is co-editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper with Harry Dent, and you can either sign up for that newsletter on my website at pfgwm.com or at harrydent.com, and you can get that newsletter. But next Saturday, we're going to have Rodney Johnson live on the air, and Rodney's written some outstanding articles lately that we're going to have a lot of fun talking to him about. And also, if you want to call in today and you want to pick up a free copy of Harry Dent's book, I'm going to give you a free copy. You can come by my office and get it. No obligation. Just come in, say you called the show, and you can get a copy. You have to call the show, though, first. You can come in and pick up a copy of the book. It's called The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. So you don't want to not know what's going on, at least in the perspective that Harry Dent has for the economy. Speaking about the economy, I'm going to introduce my two co-hosts here today. We have Kevin Stege with the Baker Coastal CPA firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Kevin. And Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And did you guys have a nice couple of weeks off here to kind of relax and get rejuvenated?
Yeah, we did. I think
we're all ready to go for a great show today. Now we're not going to give you the fire that Mr. Michaels gives you the hour before here, but I do have to say the hour before that, if you want to get up early and hear a really good show, the Wall Street on the Watchdog of Wall Street is on in the morning. I think about 6 o'clock to 7. And that is a great show. I get up and listen to it, and I absolutely like the show. So
that gets you going for this.
It gets you going. I don't need any caffeine once I hear him or Michaels, either one. They're both loaded on caffeine. Anyway, this is a show that's interactive, and we would gladly answer your questions. If you want to give us a call at 503-417-7626, that's 503-417-7626. And if you're calling long distance or if you're outside the local area, maybe listening to us on the web, you can call us at 800-990-0750. That's 800-990-0750. And at this point of the show is when I like to give the stock report to kind of get the juices going here and get everybody revved up, because I think what's going on in the market is very, very important for all of us because we need to know what is happening in the economy. And, for example, right now the Dow Jones closed at 16,775.74. And if you remember in our conversations with Harry Dent, he's looking for that 17,000 mark. When the market approaches that and goes through that, that's when we could have a major correction in the market. Dow Jones reached 16,775.74, is up 41.55, and up a quarter of a point. Now, how's the Dow Jones done since the last market correction on 10/9/07 when the Dow was at 14,164.53? Well, we're exactly up 18.43% for 6 years and 8.5 months. That's a 2.75% per year return on the Dow Jones. That's pretty pitiful.
Blowing the doors off of CDs.
Absolutely. Just killing CDs at 20 basis points or half a basis point. Yeah. The Dow closed on 12/31/99 at 11,497.12. So in 13 years and 5.5 months, we are up 45.91% or 3.41. And I got to say, that's better. That's better than the last 7 years. So the first half, all the complaint about the market stuff, the first half of the decade has been better than the second half of the 14 years. So whatever that means, I don't know that it means a lot other than to say that the market's not really going up. It's going down and it's stagnant. The S&P closed at 1936. It was up 6.05 and up 31 basis points. So where do we stand when it hit the all-time high on 10907 of 1565.15? Well, we're 23.70 up. In 6 years, 8.5 months, that's 3.53%. Now, that's getting better. It had been down around 2% for a long, long time. So it is starting to move up the other way. However, the S&P closed on 12/31/99 at 1469.25, so it's up 31.78% in 13 years, 5.5 months, or 2.56. Now, it's interesting. The S&P was worse the first 7 years and is better the next 7 years. And that to me, would signify growth because the Dow Jones represents 30 big slug stocks that are the biggest and the baddest, where the S&P 500 represents 500 growth stocks. So I think the 500 growth stocks would tend to be more in the growth. That is a good sign. However, when you talk about 3.53 in an index that the 80 years prior to the turn of the century did over 10%, that's still way, way behind. A couple of things that concern me in the United States. One of them is oil closed at 106.96, and the last time I reported on 524 was 104. It's a crying shame in this country when we have the oil reserves we have and the ability to get them out, and yet we're still not building refineries. We're still not running the Keystone Pipeline. We're still not taking advantage of the oil in this country. It's just insane. It's insane that we're not taking advantage of it for the jobs, because God knows we need jobs in America. And number two, we're not taking advantage of it for the American citizen to get a lower price on oil. We're still at the mercy of the Saudis or the oil cartels, and it's insane that we're doing that. It totally is insane. Gold closed at 1,277, and last time I reported, gold was 1,293. And if you kind of missed it in some of the conversation we've been having with Harry Dent on our show live, Harry has made the prediction that by 2020, gold's going to be at around $750 an ounce. So that's not exactly a growth investment. I would not be putting the farm on it. Now the 10-year bond rate closed at 2.60 yesterday, and that's actually a little higher than from 524. It was at 2.536. So watch the 10-year bond rate, because when interest rates start going up, I can foresee a lot of problems.
Yeah. Well, I see one of our local stocks, Intel, took a bit of a jump yesterday, up almost 7%. I'm assuming that was based on an earnings report that came out or something along those lines.
Yeah, you know, Intel has just been a stock that has been Intel and Microsoft both have been almost flat stocks for quite a while. I mean, they're just cash cows. They just keep making money. They have very little debt. They have tons of cash. So, you really can't put Microsoft and Intel used to be two of the big great growth stocks, but they're really not growing that much. They just keep making money and keep, putting out revenue.
Intel's been hanging around at 24 for I don't know how many years, and to see it go up to about 25, 26 and now jump up to near 30, that's kind of surprising. So maybe
their
transition to the mobile computing area maybe is going well for them.
Well, as long as they control the chip market, which they have, and control that and keep control of it, they're going to be okay. But I really wonder what's going to happen as we move on down the modern technology. And you know, I was watching a program the other morning, and they were talking about virtual reality. And how far away is it when you're going to actually be able to put on a headset and look into glasses and actually be in a whole different world than you're really in? And it's not that far away. And so I don't know where these companies are in that kind of process. But, boy, I'll tell you, right now computers are almost not even needed anymore because you can do everything off your phone or off your iPad. And you can even direct them to print stuff off a printer. So I don't know what's going to be. And I'm not really sure where Dell and a lot of these companies that specialize in computers, where they're going to be at down the road. I don't think you can exactly call that a growth company.
Yeah. I don't know if businesses are ready to give all their information over to the cloud yet, though. I you know, there's at least the old crowd, old business folks, I think, like to have a little more security with their information, own their own information, and not have it out there. But, you know,
our offices just went through, and we're going through, we had the XP office, and of course we had to change that, and I think go to the what's called the 360, and because they did away with they're going to do away with the service on the office. And I'm telling you, it's been a nightmare. It's been a really tough change. I don't know if either of your offices have gone through the. Then you know what I'm talking about.
I do. We're that next whatever above XP, and the hardest thing is that even though it does roughly the same thing, all of the things that you're used to seeing are either not there or they're somewhere else. And so you look on the screen and you're not, it's not familiar anyway. You don't know where all the stuff is that you used to use.
Yeah, the problem is for me, because I use a lot of documents, and you guys probably do too, but before I could make changes on a document and then just simply change them over. Now you got to save them, then send it over, where before I could just do it, send it over, and then save it, because that's what I was used to doing. Now I got to do it just the reverse. And some things you have to do two or three steps where you used to do one. So I don't know. It's supposed to be modern technology to me. It kind of looks like a way for Microsoft to make an awful lot of money.
Well, surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise, yeah. Well, listen, if you've got a question about investing, you've got a question about the law, or you got a question about taxes, give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Or toll free, 800-990-0750. That's 800-990-0750. And again, if you call this morning and ask a question, you can get a free copy of Harry Dent's book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014-2019. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Carl's comments. And I understand Carl's got a lot of interesting things to talk about on the law.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back.
Let's face it, the rules of retirement have changed. What we were told to do just a few years ago now seems like a pipe dream. Hi, this is Michael Burnett for Chuck Price, owner of Price Financial Group Wealth Management. You know the drill. Be a loyal employee. You'll get a pension. Your home will be worth 10 to 20 times what you paid for it when you retire. So how's that working for you? Call Chuck Price right now. He's located right here in Portland. Featured expert on Investing Simplified on AM 970. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or close to retiring, and he focuses on protection of principal and tax strategies to minimize your taxes. Call right now and get Chuck's retirement report. It's packed full of information on generating more income during retirement, how to leave more to your heirs, and so much more. 503-253-3000. Chuck Price, Price Financial Group Wealth Management, on the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepsen.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepsen with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I'm really glad to be back after a couple of weeks off. We skipped last week because of the Rose Parade, because they didn't have a float for us, so we decided we better just stay here and stay in bed and watch it on TV or something. But anyway, we're back, and this is the time when I talk about something that's come up in my practice. And one of the things that often comes up in a probate, and a lot of people think a probate is kind of a bad thing, and in some respects it might be. But one of the things that it does is it pays the expenses respecting the decedent. And or it's supposed to. And however, there is a priority of how those expenses are to be paid. And it becomes really problematic if there's very little cash money left after everything gets done. But so I just thought you might like to know what gets paid and who gets paid first. And it's sort of in this order. The very first thing is support of the spouse and children of the decedent. So if there are needs of the spouse and the children, you can get support from supposing that there's cash money to use, you can use that for the support of the surviving spouse and children during the course of the probate. Now, after that, they're kind of on their own, I guess, except for whatever property they end up getting. Number two are the expenses of administration. And that includes things like filing fees and, personal representative fee, and my personal favorite, the attorney's fees. So that's number two.
I can't understand how that would be your favorite.
Well, I was really surprised that we were behind the, wife and kids. But anyway, nonetheless, that's what it works. And then number three, the expenses of a, and I want to put this in quotes, plain and decent funeral, close quote. Okay? And the reason for I say that is because, you think of funeral expenses, and funeral expenses can be, a little bit or a whole lot. And so the thing is that if you don't have enough money to pay all of the claims, then what they typically do within a class of claims, they prorate them, so they get, prorate a little less money. Well, if you have spent a tremendous amount and that typically is the thing that people pay first. So, a lot of times a relative will pay all of the funeral expenses. And if they've spent, $20,000 on a funeral, and then it turns out that the estate doesn't have a whole lot of money, they might risk the possibility they're not going to get reimbursed for all that money. So, just a thought should consider.
So maybe don't get that deluxe casket then that's airtight, watertight.
Well, it's like the gold casket or whatever. Yeah.
You might first want to make sure who's going to pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a thought, So anyway, and it's one of those things that could come as a very rude surprise. I appreciate that people would want to do something nice for your decedent loved one, but he is dead. So anyway, number four, debts and taxes that have federal priority. Surprise, surprise. Next, number five, the reasonable, and this is interesting too. Guess what gets paid first here?
I'm surprised taxes are number four. I thought they should be up above family and attorneys.
I thought they'd
attorneys.
Be number one.
What taxes? Yeah, well, no, that's number four. That's the way it works. Okay. Taxes for federal, that are by federal preference are number four. Number five, reasonable and necessary medical expenses and hospital expenses of the last illness. Wow. You got to pay the taxes before there's nothing more certain than death and taxes, and they get you after you're dead. So there you go. So anyway, number six is taxes with regard to the state of Oregon. So you're the next thing in line. No surprise there, I guess. Then and this one makes some sense. Debts from the decedents for the employees of the decedents who have earned their wages in the last 90 days before he died. Those also have the next priority. So, in other words, if you're an employer and you have employees and when you died, they quit getting paid. Well, for that 90 days, 90 days before that, they get paid out of the estate.
Man, you might want to make sure that your employer has a business continuation policy or something in effect.
Yeah, could be.
To make sure the employees get paid.
And if people had, say, for example, they had hung on for a long, long time. Suppose they'd gone 6 months without any pay. Well, that could be problematic, even though there's this 90-day thing. That's just for the preference, but it would still be a claim against the estate. So part of it would be preferential claim that would get paid in that priority, and then afterwards, if there was anything left, then they'd get something else after that. So number eight, child support arrearages again. How about that? So decedent had child support that they had arrearages on. That's a number eight priority according to the statutes. Number nine, claims of the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services for medical type expenses. So if they're on the Oregon Health Plan or something like that, Medicaid kinds of things, medical stuff. Number 10, other types of public assistance claims, being cared for in a nursing home or a long-term care place or those kinds of things. This is an interesting one. Number 11 is the cost of care and a maintenance in a state institution from DHS. There aren't many of those, I don't think, but if they were in some kind of a care facility run by the DHS, they would get that. Number 12, here's a real interesting one, claims by the corrections department for care in a corrections facility. Now, I think that there's some limitations on that, but that's an interesting thing. And so if you're in jail and you die and you have property outside the jail, you may actually end up paying for your stay there, or part of it. So that's one I've never seen come up before, but I guess it could.
Well, probably the estate has went to zero by the time it hits that.
Well, I would think so, but yeah. And then number 13, these are the more normal claims. Claims that are presented to the personal representative within 4 months and are legitimate claims. Those could be any kinds of things, credit cards, any kinds of bills that they might have, those sorts of things. And then number 14, claims that were presented after the 4 months but before the final accounting. And so if you're going to have a claim against the state, you want to file your claim really early rather than wait for the final accounting. So that's it, number 14. And so that's kind of I don't know whether that's interesting to anybody, but I never thought about it myself that much until I started doing probate work. You have to think of those things, especially if you have a meager estate that you want to distribute. You got to look at those things and say, well, how many of these things do we have to pay? Usually you don't get all 14 by any means, but it's something to think about.
So number 15 would be the residual beneficiaries.
Yeah, the number 15 would be the beneficiaries. Yeah.
Anything that's left after those.
Exactly. So
wow, might be a really good reason to do a little estate planning and maybe have a trust.
Yeah, it might be a good
and
idea.
A will and some things to make sure that this doesn't have to happen.
Well, the big thing is, don't go to jail. Those kinds of things are good.
Well, that's always kind of a good thing.
Yeah. So anyway, that's it. And if anybody has any questions, give me a call. And if you have the circumstance of becoming a personal representative in an estate, you'll know that you have to think about those things and give them some credence because they do come up. Generally, like I said, not all of those. In fact, usually very few of those are involved. But it does happen, and every now and then you have to make some priorities. And we've had occasions where we've had to tell claimants, well, we don't have that much money. Here's your 20% of whatever it was, so that's the best you can do.
Carl, one question we get quite often is after an estate is closed, it's gone through the courts, through probate, so on and so forth. How much should a personal representative hold back? Just in case there's a contingency after something happens, down the road. And for how long should they hold that?
That's a good question. Two questions. One thing, usually holdbacks, there's a little bit of controversy about how that is done, but it's done all of the time. And usually what happens is you hold back an amount that you think is necessary to pay things that you're expecting to pay, the cost of the final tax return preparation. We try to take care of our CPA friends, and then also whatever the taxes might be paid. So we try to get some sense of what might have to be paid for the final tax return that probably has to be filed the year after the estate is closed. And then also there may be additional attorney's fees depending on what's to be done. So those kinds of things. And maybe there are some other expenses that you're expecting coming in. So you usually try to estimate what those are. Use that. Different ways of doing it. One of the preferred ways is to put the money in the lawyer's trust account, preferred by the lawyer, because they don't want the client to run off with the money and then find out that there's no money to pay this stuff with. Not that it, although it's the personal representative's responsibility to get that stuff paid. So anyway, that's that. So as far as holding it, you'd hold it until you spend it, and then usually what happens is the rest gets distributed in proportion to whatever the interests of the remaining beneficiaries are. So then, as far as other than that, you wouldn't ordinarily hold it very long, you know, like a year, maybe. Other than that, most claims, if they haven't made a claim or the, you know, during the course of the probate, most of those are barred by the statute. That's one of the benefits of probate, is that you cut off the rights of most creditors if they don't file a timely claim. So,
very good.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here. If you want to give a call and ask a question, 503-417-7626, 503-417-7626, or toll-free, 800-990-0750. That's 800-990-0750, Investing Simplified. We'll be right back with Kevin Stege and the Tax Investigator.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified on a beautiful summer Saturday morning. Guess we're not technically in summer yet, but boy, sure feels like we're starting to get there. And Carl, that was good stuff on the order of expenses. That's good to know. Good to know where everyone fits in that order when there's many fingers in the pot. But, you know, before I get to the tax investigator, I just wanted to take a quick moment to stand up on my little soapbox here. And, nowadays, I think men often get a bad name, sometimes deservedly so, but not all men fit the stereotypical, uncaring, dense, selfish, childish, bar-hopping womanizer profile that's out there. There are some men that are different, some that are strong physically, spiritually, ready to lend a listening ear and give good advice, even if it's not what you wanted to hear. To somebody that says what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong, and that care about life and the things that matter. And I happen to be blessed to have one of those men as my father. And so I just wanted to say, if my dad's listening right now, happy Father's Day, and I'm eternally grateful for
and you know, that's to all fathers out there, happy Father's Day.
Absolutely right.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we got a caller on the line. Tom has a call, a question about probate. Tom, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
So here's the deal. My mom had a will drawn up in Illinois back in 2000. My mom passed away earlier this year with real property in Oregon. Illinois does not require witnesses to the will, the signatures, to be notarized. Oregon does. And so when I submitted the will in Oregon courts, they wanted to go back find the witnesses. Could only find one of them. The witness is actually an attorney, and she refuses to verify her signature to sign an affidavit. By a telephone conversation, she said she remembered my mom. She made no, I mean, my mom was competent, so that sort of thing I don't think is a factor. My mom lived for another 12 years, did her own finances, lived independently. So my question is this. One, other than intestate, is there a way to try to prove my mom's signature on the will by other documents that she signed? Or is there a way to actually, we're only talking about one house, is there a way to sort of get title insurance at a higher premium and sell the house without probate? And my third question is there anything that I can do with this attorney who witnessed the will but refuses to cooperate with what I believe is her sort of officer of the court duty once she signed it to actually say, yes, that was me, I did witness it? She doesn't deny that it's her signature. She just won't go forward with an affidavit for, I don't know why, liability reasons? Not sure. What do you think?
Well, let me start with number two. The can I get it out of probate somehow, get the title print transferred? The answer is probably not. You know, if you went through intestate succession, you could. But that probably, I'm guessing that intestate succession does something different than what, you know, what's in the will. I mean, but let's go back to one of the things that could be done, nobody can find the other witness, I take it, on the will.
Died.
Okay. Well, under Oregon law, you could have, I'm surprised, I'm not sure what would be the process to do this exactly, but you might consider trying to go to Illinois and take this lady's deposition. Take her deposition, and there's a process for doing that. We're talking about a fair amount of money to do this, but you might consider threatening her to do that. That will come and depose you, and you know she says she knows the will. It is her signature, but she won't give you an affidavit. Well, then you know that strikes me as, quite frankly, I'm not sure that it's unethical to do that. If she really says yes, that's my signature, then I mean, unless she's got some other really good reason, I don't know why she wouldn't provide you with an affidavit.
I don't either.
And I'm not sure that, you know, I think she owes a duty to her client. If she drafted the will and she witnessed it. Pardon me?
She did not draft the will. I think she was just an attorney who was in the office of the attorney who drafted the will, and they needed two signatures. She allegedly volunteered.
Well, either way, I think, I don't know why they wouldn't sign an affidavit. There wouldn't be any liability to that whatsoever. In fact, here's another idea. That's the only reason I could think of that they would have some concerns. And so maybe what you should do is, hey, look, it. All of the family members or whoever named in the will indemnify you from any liability. We'll release you from any liability that you might have had having to do with this will, so long as all you got to do is attest to what you saw. That, you know, in other words, it was her signing it and it was, you know, my signature.
We have done that. I have actually had my attorney send her an affidavit. It's been like 5 or 6 weeks now, and she just has not signed, sort of slow-walking it, won't return messages or calls.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why she wouldn't, and we have also offered her the, you know, indemnity kind of deal.
Wow. So I guess there are two things, I guess, is, you know, like I said, there is a process to get what's called a commission to take a foreign deposition, hire some lawyer in wherever she lives.
And not do it like a phone deposition?
Well, yeah, you could, but I think it would be easier to get somebody there face-to-face with her. You know, it wouldn't be very expensive to get a lawyer. The facts wouldn't be much. They'd say, is this your signature? And she'd say, yes. Very good, you know. I mean, she'd be sworn under oath, and you'd have a deposition.
Is there not a concern whether my mom was competent at the time? I mean, proving the signature is certainly part of it, but isn't competency the other half?
But unless, you know, it's presumed to be competent unless somebody's claiming otherwise. So I mean, as far as I know, nobody's claiming that she was incompetent, right? I mean,
you wouldn't
be facing a will contest if the will was allowed to go forward. So I don't see it as a problem. I would try that as a first step. You know, seek a deposition of her, and then secondly, if she doesn't give it to you, I'm not sure that I wouldn't report her to the bar.
I was going to say, can't you go to the bar on that?
I don't know whether you could force her to do that, but by forcing her, that would be well, that's why I'm saying. Rather than file an action in there, you could do it, I think, under the probate. And like I said, it's a commission to take a foreign deposition, and there is a process to do that, and you could go to another state. The simplest way probably is to have some other lawyer. You know, you give them all the questions you want them to ask, and yes, you could have a telephone, you know, conference kind of thing with it, I guess. You could videotape it. You could do all number of things, But you certainly could get her sworn testimony that was her signature. Then if somebody else wants to come and complain about it, fine. But I would think that if she doesn't, she's not going to want to do that. I think she's very, very wrong in doing what she's doing. If she's honestly saying that, yes, that's my signature, yes, I saw the will, and I have no idea, you know, then, you know, I don't see why.
One last follow-up. Mm-hmm. I am the only child. I'm the person who is named in the will for personal representative and to inherit this house. There are no other siblings.
Well, so you're the only heir, is it?
Correct. Yes.
Oh, well, then I would just
go in.
I guess what I would do is just say, since you're going to get it anyway, do intestate succession.
Right, and that's what I think we're planning on doing. But obviously, we needed to go down the road as far as we could with this uncooperative.
Sure. And then I guess what I would do is just, if you feel like it, you know, consider complaining to the bar it didn't cost you anything. I mean, it did, but I mean, in the sense you didn't lose anything from the estate. But so yeah, if you're the sole heir, I would just go ahead and do that.
Okay. I appreciate your help. That's exactly, I think, what we're going to do. And yes, I will file a bar complaint.
I don't understand why she wouldn't do that.
As an officer of the court, I think I can understand why someone wouldn't want to witness a will, because there is some potential liability. But
once
you've done it as an officer of the court, I think you do have the responsibility to go forward and follow out.
Well, I suppose there might be. I'm just trying to think, you know, where she might be coming from. One of the things is that when you attest to a will, you essentially are attesting that they seem to be competent to you. I mean, if you look at the affidavit that you asked her to sign, and if it says, to the best of my knowledge, she appeared to be, you know, confident and of, you know, sound mind and not acting under duress or undue influence, or words to that effect, then she may say, I just don't remember well enough to know that, so I can't attest to that. And that may be your problem. I don't know. In which case, then, maybe that's okay, except that I think it's, why would she have signed the will if she thought that? So that's,
right.
That's another question. So,
well, anyway. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
You bet. Thanks for the call.
Great. And we're going to go back to Kevin, the tax investigator.
Well, that was good advice there, Carl. I think he got some bang for his buck there.
Yeah.
That was a good call.
It was. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, today we're going to look at a scenario that came up over this last week. It wasn't with a client of mine, but I have a friend in Denver who's a CPA, and it was a situation that he had with a client. And the situation is, and I think this fits under the umbrella of advanced tax planning, or maybe tax damage control, I think is a better term. And this is a scenario where we'll call it just a taxpayer. The taxpayer owed the IRS $100,000. They had an IRA that had roughly $100,000 in it, and that was pretty much their only liquidity. Apparently, that was all they could look toward to pay this tax debt down. Now, first off, I have to say, when you owe the IRS $100,000, usually that means at some point you had the income to have paid the tax, since tax is always just a percentage of income. Doesn't always mean you've actually got the cash, but a lot of times it does. So hopefully it was a profitable endeavor that got him into this place. So don't feel too sorry about owing $100,000 to the IRS at this point. So owes $100,000 to the IRS. What are his options, his or her options? Liquidate the IRA, just take a distribution and pay the IRS the net proceeds after taxes. Well, the first problem, someone would say, well, under age 59 and a half, he's going to have a 10% penalty on top of the income taxes. Fortunately, one of the exceptions to liquidating an IRA to pay a tax debt is if you're liquidating it to pay a debt That's right. to the IRS. So he gets to escape the 10% penalty, but by the time you add 100 grand into your other income, you're minimum 25% federal, 9% Oregon, possibly bumping up into the AMT. You're going to be losing about 40,000 of that to taxes. And so now you only have 60,000 to pay your $100,000 debt. You still have to come up with $40,000. So that's not a great scenario. So what this taxpayer did was they created, and this is where the advanced tax planning comes into effect, and it's not a bad method to consider, is they formed an S corporation. Apparently they had an active trader business. They took the IRA, rolled it into the S corporation, made it a part of the S corp's retirement planning package for the employees, and then borrowed from the IRA to pay the tax debt, and then sat back with a cigar in their mouth, because when you borrow from a plan, it's not considered a distribution. So the question is, does the taxpayer get to really sit back with the cigar in their mouth?
Well, they can probably still do that, but they're probably unconscious, and when it gets to their lips, it's going to hurt like the devil, because there's definitely a hook in that, because you can't really borrow from the IRA.
You're absolutely right. The taxpayer in this case is Wile E. Coyote, and the cigar is actually a stick of dynamite that is going off shortly, because you cannot. That is correct. You cannot borrow from your IRA. Doesn't matter if it's in a business, if you hold it outside of your business, when you borrow from your IRA, you have disqualified your IRA, and it's not just the amount you borrowed, it's the whole IRA becomes disqualified and becomes taxable at that point. And I would even wager to say, now you don't get the 10% penalty relief because you've taken the money potentially. So I don't know, that could be a point that the IRS would have. So what should have the taxpayer done? He was close. He got the IRA over into the S corporation.
Well, what he should have done is set up if he had a business, he could set up a 401k, put that transfer that IRA into his 401k, then he could legitimately borrow against the 401k.
Absolutely right. That's absolutely right. That's the detail that was missed in this situation, is there's a difference between an IRA and a qualified plan. And it's the difference is night and day. There's different rules, different exceptions for each one of those. And he should have, his S corp should have set up a 401k with, I don't know if Price Financial.
Yeah, we've actually done this with a couple of people who were referred to us actually by CPAs, mm-hmm. Who referred people to us because they had a business and they actually needed the money for, not for the IRS, thank goodness. But they needed to use the money for their business, and they had no other sources of revenue except their had a pretty substantial IRA,
mm-hmm.
and so we set up a 401k plan, transferred their IRAs into the 401k, then set up a loan for them, and they actually borrowed their own money to help their business, and it turned out very profitable. They ended up paying off the loan and making money in their business, so it works.
That's exactly right.
Well, I was going to say though, isn't there a There was a caveat on that borrowing from the 401k, I think, and that is, if for some reason you're unable to pay that back, what happens?
Well, that's the devil is in the details.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when you set up the 401k, you need proper meeting minutes to say, we're intending to do this. You need to do the proper rollover of your IRA in there. Then you can borrow. You need a proper note with proper...
You need a structured loan payment process where you can show the guy's actually making payments on the loan.
With the applicable federal rate for interest.
Yep.
And that's right. The other rules that apply to, even if you're working at Intel and you borrow from the 401k, there's rules that that attach. And one is if you break service with that employer, typically that loan becomes due in full
immediately,
and you have to you have a very short time to pay that back, or it becomes a distribution to you.
You mean the loan? Okay, so let's suppose that our guy here. This let's play what if. So what if our guy did that? He set up his 401k. He's got his $100,000 loan now. And then, say, 2 years later, he becomes totally disabled and the business fails. And he there's no way he can pay it back. You know, does that mean it becomes a distribution when he defaults on the loan?
If he can't pay it back, a lot of times the repayment schedule may not have to be monthly. Fortunately, you may have, you can accrue the interest and so on and so forth. So as long as he's still a viable entity, if you will, as an individual, he may be okay. But if he were to die, that would become
a distribution.
Or
suppose it had a 5-year payout on the note, and mm-hmm. and they get to the 5 years, and
exactly.
and there's still the balance due.
Right.
So then that would be a distribution.
Absolutely right.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's definitely one of the rules that you have to consider and make sure you follow the rules on that. But if it's done right, one of the huge benefits is the interest that you pay on
that. Yours.
It's yours.
Yeah, that's
you're
right.
paying it.
Yeah,
back.
It's a heck of a good deal if you do it correctly.
Exactly.
And it works.
Yep.
It's a good deal.
Yep.
As a lot of things in planning, if it works, it's a good deal.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that's the tax investigator for today.
Well, you hate to be, you really hate to have to go to court because, court, there are people, witnesses get sworn in and all that stuff. And that was the other thing I was going to talk about on Carl's comments was when you go to court, you always have to raise your right hand and swear an oath, and mm-hmm. and you ever wonder why they did that? And that's, I didn't know that. And actually, I was reading an article that came to us from we get stuff from the Washington State Bar all the time. And it's entitled, "Why Do We Raise Our Right Hands When We're Testifying Before Court?" Well, it turns out that the origin of this is back in about the 17th century London and the judges in the criminal courts. And, they were pretty rough folks back in those days, and they dealt very harshly with criminals. So they had penalties of everything from, little sentences or fines or whatever to death. I mean, and almost everything in between. But one of the things they didn't have back in those days, they didn't have any real realistic way to keep track of a criminal's record. So a lot of times they would, if they had some, special church affiliation or something, they might have some special dispensation to get some leniency. Well, then if they did something else, they wouldn't necessarily know. And so they wouldn't, a lot of times, if you're a second time criminal, you're going to get treated worse than if you're a first time criminal and that kind of stuff. So as a way of keeping track, what they would do is they would basically brand them. They would put a brand, and initially they put it on their face. They thought later that turned out to be kind of a rough thing, and people decided not to do that. The scarlet letter, and so they put stuff like M for murder and R for rape and that kind of stuff, and then they put it on their hands, on their right hand,
like brand it with
and they brand it, and so that was one way that the judge could see, he'd say, "Hey, show me your hand," and that would be so he would have some idea of the history of this guy as to what he was going to pass sentence on.
Well, Carl, one of the things, since you brought this up, it brings up an interesting question to me is because on all the legal shows on TV, you see these guys, they mm-hmm. go into court and they say, do you testify to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so I hope you God? And they raise the right hand mm-hmm. and say, "Yes, I do." Well, what if the guy's an atheist?
Then they say, "Swear or affirm." They say,
"Is that what they
say?" Yeah, they say, "Do you swear or affirm?" Because the guy can't say no; he's got to do something. So then, usually, they'll say, "If he's not going to agree to that, he just says, 'I swear or affirm that it's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.'"
Oh, so there is an out.
Yeah,
for
there's
those
an out
people.
For him.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
we got a caller. We got a caller, Andy, has a question for Chuck. So, Andy, are you there?
Yeah. Good morning. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Say, a while back, I heard you talking about the 401k that it might be wise to go into cash for a while. Do you still think that?
Well, depending on the options that you have in your 401k, I would say right now, with the way the market is, if you don't have enough options in your 401k where you can go into a safer haven of a money market or some kind of a government treasury account where your money's going to be relatively safe. Yeah, I think right now is an excellent time to put money into cash to get out of the market, because I think we're going to have a major correction in the market. I don't think it's happening right now. The little blip we had the last 3 days or last 2 days and then yesterday was up. I don't think that's the one coming that's going to be the big decline. But I think somewhere here this year we're going to have a pretty good size correction in the market.
I see.
And then, Andy, I'll tell you what I've been telling all my clients is that if you put that money in cash and we have this big decline, then that is a perfect time to start moving that money back in gradually in what we call dollar cost averaging. And if your 401k allows you to have it kind of gradually go back in each month and dollar cost average back into the market, particularly in a down market, that is the best way to make money.
I see. All right, I have one more question if you have time.
Absolutely. For you, of course.
What do you think of Bitcoin?
I think Bitcoins are a bit. I don't think it's going to work. I don't think the governments are going to allow another form of currency outside of a government organization, and I don't think in the long run they're going to work out at all. I think people are going to lose a lot of money, and I don't think Bitcoins are going to prove to be another currency at all down the road.
Is there ever any real money put into it, or?
Well, yeah, there are people who put a lot of money into those. And the question is are you going to get it back?
You know, there was an article here not too long ago about a guy, and I don't know whether he had some kind of a deal with Bitcoins whereby he was basically, he had obligations that had to be paid on Bitcoins, and as it turned out, it all fell apart. And it turns out that there wasn't any money that went behind it. So he ended up, you know, having to come up with real money to pay the obligations based on the transactions that he'd had done with the Bitcoins.
You know, unless you're like the United States federal government and the Japanese government, where you can print money on demand and you can print currency on demand and not have to worry about backing it up with anything, and I don't see people investing in something like that, at least if they've got any brains, that they're going to come out because there's nothing backing it.
I see. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Thanks for the call.
Happy Father's Day to you.
Hey, you too. Happy Father's Day.
Thanks.
Okay, and listen, we're gonna come right back with the Knowledge Trust. Actually, we only have about 5 or 6 minutes, so let's just go around here. And Kevin, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, how do they get a hold of you?
Well, we're at BakerColson.com, and we're located at 2414 Northeast Division out in Gresham. And our phone number is 503-666-5569. And we've got, eight CPAs that have various areas of expertise. And we would love to hear your questions and talk with you and see if we can help.
Okay, Carl?
Well, Warren Allen is conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue. That's one block north of Gleason, and easily to reach from the I-205 exit. And phone numbers, 503-255-8795. WarrenAllen.com is our website. And we actually have, we're about the same size as you folks, and we are do many different kinds of practice. So almost any kind of law that you would have us work with, somebody in our office does it. And we'd love to talk to you, and we try to be as friendly and as convenient as we can. And actually, we try to be as economical as we can as well. So.
Okay, and Price Finance Group Wealth Management is located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue. Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, the Mall 205 area, right off the 205. And our numbers are 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. And you can reach us. And I would say right now, if you have a portfolio and you're concerned at all about your portfolio and how your portfolio is going to react in the upcoming market correction, I would be more than happy to do a free analysis of your portfolio, no obligation to you. I do this on a regular basis. We call it a financial checkup, We'll provide you a financial checkup free with no cost. Do an evaluation of your portfolio. Give it to you. If you decide to do something with us, that's fine. If you decide to do it on your own, that's okay too. I have many clients who we handle their serious money and they handle their play money, and they invest it, and they can be as aggressive as they want, and I'm fine with that. We just want to take care of the client's serious money. So if you're looking to look at what's going on in the economy, I do want to say next Saturday we're going to have Rodney Johnson on the air live from Tampa, Florida with us, and we're going to be talking about the economy. And I'll tell you, the economy's getting close to the time that Dent's been talking about and Rodney Johnson's been talking about. And so you're not going to want to miss next Saturday. And also, I'd recommend you go to my website at pfgwm.com, and you can hear our previous radio shows. You can hear some of Carl's comments of wisdom and Kevin's tax strategies and my investment strategies. You can hear them over and over again.
And some golf tips to boot.
And there might be some golf tips on there. Yeah, on the newsletter, yes.
That's right.
But not on our radio. But also, we have all the past recordings with Harry Dent or Rodney Johnson. And I highly recommend it because, you know what? Knowledge is power. And what you don't know can hurt you. So you want to learn as much as you can about the portfolio, your investment portfolio. You also want to learn as much as you can about your estate plan and your taxes, because those are things we all have to live with. And believe me, at the end of the day, it comes down to your estate plan and your taxes and your investments, what your financial net worth is. So thank you very much for listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back next Saturday with our special guest, Rodney Johnson, who's co-editor with Harry Dent of the Survive and Prosper newsletter. So thank you all very much.
Price Financial Group, wealth management. Price Financial Group, wealth management. We do investing simplified.